I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
It's a real pleasure to be back here again. I've only had happy experiences here in this wonderful shop. I'm good. I'll read for a little bit from the beginning of the book, and then I'll happily talk about it or about other things that might come up. The novel, as some of you will know, is set in 2007, largely in upstate New York, hence the title, Saratoga Springs to be exact, which is a college town, very sweet New York State college town. And it centers on a family, a 68-year-old Northern English property developer called Alan Quarry and his two daughters who are 40 and 38. Helen is, Vanessa is 40 and Helen is 38. Helen works in London as a record producer, music executive, and Vanessa teaches at Skidmore College, which is the college in Saratoga Springs, where she teaches philosophy. So I'll just start at the very beginning of the book, in which Alan goes to tell his mum, who's pretty aged, that he's going over to the States. He's in fact going over to the States to deal with another crisis in the life of his daughter Vanessa, but he doesn't quite tell his mother that. We'll go from there. First, he would have to go and see his mother. He would tell her something about Vanessa, but not everything, of course. The home, 6 miles along a favorite road, was a formidable old place, with that gray strictness of the north he loved. But now it looked abandoned. Everything was in wintry abeyance. 4 years she'd been living there, and he was still never sure how to announce himself. It was also ridiculously expensive. He could no longer afford it. What did he get for that money? 2 small rooms rather than one, extra space for the dark massing of a lifetime's heavy old furniture. And maybe she got 2 biscuits with her tea on Fridays. He made his way through 2 huffing fire doors, which bottled a weekend's stale yeast, school food. Outside his mother's room, Clarendon, he gathered himself a bit like a clown, pulling up his trousers, dusting down his coat, and entered with a light knock. The television was off, thank goodness. She was asleep in the chintz chair his father had used as the family throne, issuing directives and decrees from behind his newspaper. She was tiny, sunken. Some of her teeth were out. The old music hall joke. Her teeth are like stars, they come out at night. But it was early afternoon. As she breathed, something seemed to catch in her throat. She'd always had a large nose, and now she seemed to be reducing around it, shrinking down to bone, the nose tenacious, final, root-like. I have hers, so this will be mine, right enough. He knelt beside her and whispered. She opened her eyes and said with a slight affront, "When did you get here, Alan?" As if he'd been spying on her. "Just a second ago." "Fetch me my teeth, by the side of the bed, please, in the glass." She turned away from him to insert the plate. "Now we need to call for tea and biscuits. They'll bring it if you ask." As a child in a lower middle class suburb of Edinburgh, She'd made herself unpopular at school by affecting an English or maybe Anglo-Scots pronunciation. Since his dad's death, her accent seemed to have moved up the ranks again by another notch or two. It usually had the effect of making her sound slightly irritable. In truth, these days she sounded like the mistress, but looked more like the servant. Short, bent, too modestly or shabbily dressed today. "You don't need to wear this shawl thing, do you?" he said, lifting it over her shoulders. "Certainly not. I just put it on for my nap. Thank you. You look very tired. You know, you can't burn your candle at both ends." "A Roman candle, maybe." He just had his 68th birthday. "How are you?" "All right, I suppose, but this English view isn't my landscape, of course," she added, gesturing at the window with splendid authority. "Well, it's not a bad one," he said, looking at the line of leafless trees and the icy hills. He was paying for that English view. "And we've been over this. You don't want to live with me. You need your independence, though it would be a lot cheaper if you did move in with us." "Absolutely not. I took in your grandmother, as you perfectly well know, and it made my 50s a complete blank. All I did day after day was look after her. I'll never do that to you." In that house, the two women had seemed to detest each other with stealthy expertise. Each made the other immovably depressed. "But you want me to visit, and I want to visit you." He took her hand. "You're no good to me 3 hours away up in Scotland, even though you'd have your own landscape there." He said it gently. The tea arrived, carried by a very red teenaged boy. He offered a biscuit to both of them and then left, making sure to take the full plate with him. "Wartime rations round here," said his mother. The young man appeared again. "Mrs. Querry," he said, "I'm supposed to remind you that the residents are gathering at 3:30 in the Sun Lounge for the winter flu vaccination. It's, you know, the booster for them that missed it first time round. Need any help?" "No, I have my son. Thank you." The room could have been a lot worse. High ceilings with ornate mouldings, Roman laurels almost. Textured wallpaper with chips in it like slivered almonds. Though, in fact, these always made him think of splinters caught under a child's skin. All painted a pleasant cream. And parental things he'd known all his life. A reproduction watercolor of Durham Cathedral, an antique mirror that you couldn't really see yourself in. It looked valuable, but he knew it wasn't. A cushion whose faded lilac cover, bought by him at Heels, London, on the Tottenham Court Road, had not been replaced in 30 years at least. It was all pretty good, or as good as can be when one's whole life has been reduced to souvenirs of selfhood. It was a nice place, but he couldn't afford it any longer. She looked at him with her pale blue eyes, Vanessa's. "This whole place is up in arms. My next door neighbor lost a hearing aid yesterday. She put it in some tissue paper on her bedside table, and the cleaner threw it out by mistake. She thought it was a bit of rubbish. And in the room that's just two doors down the hall, Mary Binet is furious because she likes to talk French to another woman here who can understand it. She's the only woman who can. And now Mary's been told to stop talking French by the staff, apparently someone else, we all assume it's one of the residents, and I have a very good idea who, has complained that they're speaking a secret language to exclude everyone else. I'll miss it. I couldn't understand what they were saying, but I liked hearing the French. And now the manager is leaving at the end of the month. She's only been here for 6 months. She's Czech, I think, a nice woman, though for some reason she hates to be thought of as Polish." He interrupted her. "Ma, I have to go to America for a week." "America? Well, well, on business?" She'd always enjoyed enunciating these words, so he spoke them back to her with finality. "On business. Well, don't get caught up in anything." "Caught up in anything? It's a dangerous place from what I hear. There was that terrible thing with the towers. You'll go and see Vanessa? She's always wanted you to visit her in that place, in Saratoga Springs." "Yes, I wanted to say sarsaparilla. I will see her. And Josh? Oh, good Lord, courage there. He's far too young and certainly not good enough for her." "You've never even met him." "Yes, that's two of us, but I do have a telephone here, you know. I get reports. And I was about to say, before you interrupted me, that Vanessa isn't getting any younger, is she?" "Ma, I can't keep up with you. Now you're giving him your blessing." "Well, why shouldn't the poor thing have a boyfriend? Maybe Josh is the one. And when they marry, you'll blame him for taking Vanessa away." "Oh, Vanessa was already away. Well away. She did her PhD there, not here, after all. That was the beginning. Silly girl. It was a shame she didn't come back at Christmas. I suppose she'd rather spend time with her beau." There was a moment or two of old-fashioned silence. The tick of his mother's fancy carriage clock. His gift. "Alan, love, Can you help me to the sunroom? I want to get there early while the needle is still sharp. They smiled at each other and he helped her up and walked beside her as she gripped the mouse gray tubular Zimmer frame, a marvel of engineering, as strong as a weightlifter but as light as the bones of a very old lady, with wheels on the front and two splayed yellow tennis balls stuck on the back legs. These dragged along the carpet as the aged couple, mother and son, moved slowly down the corridor. Now I'm just going to skip. There's a next chapter just sort of sets up Alan's sort of posh house in Northumberland and how he's done well for himself, but also how in some way he's different from his neighbors who tend to be landed gentry, whereas his origins are working class from Durham and Newcastle. And then the next chapters, chapter four, which I'm just going to read from, and chapter five, very short chapters, just about the two daughters, Vanessa and Helen, and their differences. Vanessa and Helen, Helen and Vanessa. Vanessa was the elder by 2 years, born just after 10 o'clock on the evening of the 30th of July, 1966, the day England beat West Germany in the World Cup, the one and only time. You couldn't forget that day, those jubilant hours, the black and white television bringing forth its frail, unlikely pictures, and Kathy walking stiffly around the sitting room, pressing her hand into her lower back. Her groans mixed now in his memory with the roars from Wembley Stadium. And there, a little later, Vanessa was jaundiced and moist, furrowed with folds, most loved because she was the first, only the best for her. A lucky girl. But as she got older, she became harder to embrace, awkward, softly distant. She didn't or wouldn't fit. Like Alice in Wonderland, either too tall or too short. It was the divorce that changed everything. After Kathy walked out, Vanessa withdrew. The girls dealt differently with that catastrophe. Always fierce, Helen sided with her father and accused her mother, who had, after all, left Alan for another man, of being obsessed with sex. She was only 13, poor thing. Vanessa was different. She took no sides, just went quiet, seemed to absorb all the consequences of the event, and disappeared from sight. She was always upstairs in that damn bedroom of hers, where she lay on her bed and read, massively, widely, seriously, novels, poetry, philosophy, feminism, even ecology. He never heard of most of her authors. Sometimes he thought she chose the most obscure people she could just to spite him. In happier times, Alan and Kathy had loved to observe the differences between their daughters. How often in the evening, when other conversation faltered, the two parents talked about the girls with the kind of fanatical wonderment, monotonous but somehow never boring, that revolutionaries must lavish on their plans for the future. Helen was exuberant, playful, disobedient, physical. Vanessa was shy, gentle, slow to anger, studious, very private. For a while, these differences seemed provisional, part of the scramble of growing up. Everything was potential. But eventually, so Alan discovered, the child's feet stopped growing. Her trousers don't need to be let out anymore. Her handwriting has the form it will have for the rest of her life. Her bedsheets bear the occasional but unmistakable bloodstains of new adolescence. And as if suddenly, while you were not properly attending to the matter, or so it seemed to him now, while you were too busy with your own foolish crises, your daughter became an adult. And those qualities that had seemed malleable were now hardened and fixed. Both girls were full of will, but while Helen's willfulness seemed to bring her pleasure, Vanessa's brought her unhappiness. She seemed so keen to mess up her own chances. That was the phrase he kept on reciting to himself in those days. Why did she want to mess up her own chances? Why didn't Van invite any school friends over to the house? Didn't she have any friends? She said she wanted to put herself forward for the school debating society, but it never happened. It was the same with the school orchestra, the school play. All her pastimes were solitary, reading, playing the piano on the flute, listening to music, writing poems. Poems mostly full of despair and lament. One of them was especially horrifying. It seemed to be about some unrequited crush on a boy, and it ended with a line he would never forget about wanting to jump from a high wall onto a hard pavement. These poems greatly alarmed her parents when they discovered them in a notebook hidden under Van's mattress. Later, a student at Oxford, Vanessa decided that she would give away all her possessions. A friend was so worried about her stability that she reported her to the University Health Services, who contacted Alan and Kathy. Helen spoke so easily to adults, confident in her ability to charm. Vanessa held back in a gesture that seemed to combine, worst of all worlds, judgment and fear. Helen was naturally joyful. Van needed to be reminded of that category of human experience. And one day, you realize that your children's differences are not only temperamental and biological, but also moral and political, that each has a very distinct worldview. One day, he remembered it well, you witness your eldest daughter, now 17, firmly lecturing her younger sister about the misery of life and the cruelty of all human beings, of all life, holding up a book her father had no idea she possessed, George Riley Scott's History of Torture, waving it around and saying, read this, Helen, and you won't have any doubts about it. Is that how it had been? Her childhood a torture? Helen and Vanessa, Vanessa and Helen. Vanessa did her doctorate at Princeton because I'm stifled in Oxford and they'll pay for me to be at Princeton and they actually want me there. And had been 7 years teaching philosophy at Skidmore College. It was now a faint suggestion, like a breeze carrying a smell of rot with it, of a career stagnating, of unfulfilled promise. There had been a few papers, one of them which Alan understood to be about how to combine French philosophy and English analytic philosophy in order to make a great new product, like combining French grapes and English soil to make that questionable wine they were now producing in Kent, did fairly well and bounced around the conference circuit. But now she was 40, and there'd been no big book and no advancement. The same faculty profile and atrocious snapshot sat on the departmental website for all these years. These academics, thought Alan. Vanessa's beautiful dark hair pulled harshly tight at the back into a scholarly bun, her lovely intelligent face obscured by hideous clock-sized spectacles, and that fixed bibliography with the eternally dangling promise of 4 essays on personhood forthcoming. Alan couldn't imagine her in Saratoga Springs, New York. She told him that Skidmore College was one of the best private institutions in America, and she told him something about the town, about its history as a holiday resort, a 19th century spa with healing waters, the Baden-Baden, the Vichy of upstate New York. It was full of parks and grand hotels. People still gambled and raced horses there. And there were handsome, wide streets. 5 years ago, he was reading Diamonds Are Forever. He'd been rereading all the Ian Fleming books on a whim and was chuffed to see that James Bond and Felix Leiter visited the famous horse track at the very same Saratoga Springs. But he didn't go to see her. She came to him. And he imagined that she came to Northumberland every summer because she was keen to escape America or New York State. In summer, in Northumberland, the sheep made their pleated, laugh-like noises and rubbed their wool onto the dry stone walls, and the straight old Roman roads glittered in the broad, gentle light, and there was really no better place to be on earth. Last summer, she'd come for the whole of August. He liked that very much. He left her alone for a few days, went down to London, and when he came back, there she was, still there. Sometimes in her old bedroom, lying diagonally on the bed in her usual way, reading a book, sometimes in the sitting room or outside on the lawn in a deck chair, smoking, always with a book and a pen in hand, wearing those curious baggy trousers. Unlike Helen, Vanessa seemed to need very little. She wanted to be at home, to be intermittently alone, and to be able to work, little else. From the back door, he could see her in the deck chair, notebook open, pen in hand, cigarette packet and lighter on the grass beside her coffee cup. She got a bit heavier in the last year. Perhaps the curious wafting trousers were hiding that. She slouched in the chair, her tongue slightly protruding. The notebook was balanced on her knees, and with her right hand, she intensely twirled her hair as if twisting thoughts from her brain. She rarely wrote anything. Fascinating, the ratio of thought to frequency of writing. She was like a trumpeter playing Haydn in a symphony, picking up the instrument only every 100 bars or so. Aphorisms, maybe? Philosophical fragments? It would be funny if she were just writing jokes or writing a letter or doodling aimlessly. And although he knew he shouldn't, he would go out and disturb her, offer her some more coffee, ask her if she needed anything from Corbridge, tell her one of his jokes to match those in her notebook. Had she really tried to do herself some harm in Saratoga Springs? Put aside her life? He kept coming back to this image, like a half-finished crossword puzzle. After Vanessa ran away from boarding school, Alan and Kathy decided that she should see someone about her depression and anxiety. They found a child therapist in Newcastle who was attached in some way to the teaching hospital there. She was hard to find, he remembered. No one had therapy in Newcastle in 1982. And Vanessa did not want to go, had to be almost dragged into the grim office on Percy Street. Worse, much worse, the therapist, her last name was Lennon, like John, insisted that she wanted to see the whole family for the first session. All of them, even Helen. Alan and Kathy had been separated for 8 months and had stopped communicating except to talk about matters relating to the girls. Alan sat there in a fury as Dr. Lennon told them that she was going to use a tape recorder. She found it useful to listen to them talking, to detect after the session their recorded hesitations and evasions and weaknesses and lies. Of course, she didn't put it quite like that. But that was the gist. Cherche the parents, find out how the parents were to blame and stitch them up. And they were to blame. Of course they were. Poor Vanessa, she cried while the little gap-toothed wheels of the Memorex cassette squeakily rotated, while Alan and Kathy tried to explain how hard things had been for both girls. And yet, Helen did not cry, did she? Dr. Lennon then had 4 sessions with Van on her own, and when it was all over, she called in the despicable parents and explained that she couldn't, of course, share any details of what Vanessa had told her, just what had Van told her, but she could certainly inform them that, in her opinion, their elder daughter was extremely anxious and severely depressed. The therapist recommended that Vanessa write about her fears and sadness in creative form. Alan didn't mention that Van was already doing that. Van did get better, happier, more fulfilled in her academic work, drawn out by the task of serious philosophy. The last 2 years of school and the first year at Oxford were comparatively serene. Everything was comparative in Van's case. But then she collapsed again in her final year at Oxford and tried to give away all her possessions to her friends and had to be brought home by Helen. And at that time she spoke of being pursued by what she called her demons. Had she intended to harm herself at Oxford? Was she thinking of suicide? He could hardly bear to think, let alone speak that word. He had to look away from it as from the sun. And perhaps it was true, he now thought, that because he looked away from that word, he had also looked away from the other word, depression. He looked away. And by the time Van was in her mid-20s, Alan had decided that most of Vanessa's problems were not really chronic, but largely related to her solitude. She never seemed to have a boyfriend. She read books all day, hard, systematically unhelpful books, as he saw it. She took no exercise, never went for a walk or a bike ride. Ma wasn't correct when she said that if Josh were the one, Alan would blame the lad for taking his daughter away. Not at all. He welcomed Josh with relief. The news about a boyfriend was received as another parent might receive news about a child's new job or first house. And the truth was, Vanessa had been much happier in the last months, since she and Josh started going out in June. She was full of new projects and resolve, as he saw in the summer when she sat happily in the deck chair, carefully answering her philosophical riddles. He tried hard to keep this summery Vanessa in his mind, not the girl who disappeared for 2 days when she was 15, or refused to get out of bed for what seemed like a whole month when she was 21, or who very nearly abandoned her PhD 4 years later and spoke seriously about opening an organic restaurant in Corbridge, or who was about to turn down the offer of the assistant professorship at Skidmore and come home to England without a job because what's the point of teaching philosophy? What he strongly remembered today was walking with Vanessa when she was 5 or 6 past the medieval church in the village, the church that flew a red on white St. George's flag from its tower. In the northern wind, the flapping cloth pulled away from the metal pole like a young soldier eager to dash into battle. That day it was at half mast, and little Vanessa, happy Vanessa, asked him what that meant. Someone prominent had died, he said. For several years afterwards, when they went past the church and the flag was back at full mast, Van would look up and announce with satisfaction, "No one died today." Thank you. I'll be more than happy to take questions about the novel or about other aspects of writing, either writing fiction or writing about fiction. Two related, but it turns out very different activities. Happy to talk. If no questions are forthcoming, I will, as Robert Robertson put it, interview myself.
You kind of set up my first question, which was going to be essentially how you, turn off the critical voice when you do the creative process, or do you turn off the critical voice, or how you kind of navigate those waters of being both at once, or one at one time and then not?
I find it difficult, and difficult enough that in some regard I probably stopped doing it. I guess it's such a constituent part of me now, and has been overwhelmingly my writing life. Right, it hasn't been writing fiction, so it could be said that I don't have some of the, you know, some of the muscle memory even that you know a working novelist might have. So I probably don't turn it off, and I tell myself that that isn't necessarily such a bad thing, in the sense that I can at least second guess myself and usefully edit myself. All that sort of stuff does come in handy. So I think that would be the short answer, that I probably don't turn it off. I suppose the one thing I did try to do while writing it, which was a very interrupted process, I have to say, that didn't help. But one thing I did, the distinction I tried to make was I tried not to think about audience too much. Necessarily, when you're writing journalism, even if you're not thinking about an audience, you're structurally built into a relationship with the audience. You're writing it for an editor who's going to see it in, you know, 4 days' time. Not in the case of Mary Kay, who would see it in about 10 months' time. But, but you know, so you're writing it for a set of eyes, very quick, sort of temporally local. And then you're aware that, you know, a week later it's going to be in print and a certain body of people are going to see it, a much larger and much more a reliable body than will ever read this novel, for instance. So that's all built into the journalistic relationship, and I think I do think, for me at least, it's very important when writing a completely different kind of thing that I'm not considering the audience. And indeed, I don't see how you could be, because it takes long enough that the audience has to fade away a bit. So that would be that's the distinction I did try to observe, and I think an important one.
Thank you for that very generous answer to that question.
Yeah. I
wonder if I can ask you to flesh it out a bit more. I really enjoyed your reading. I know your practical work very well, but not your fictional writing.
Yeah.
When you describe things like Alan's mother's nose and how the bones are decaying around it, or the engineering feat in her trolley, or his daughter sometimes lying on the bed, sometimes in the garden, I can almost hear you as the critic talking about that.
Yeah.
And imagine what you might say about it as illuminating moments.
Yeah.
But are those thoughts going on in your mind as you write that, or
they
not?
They probably are a bit, and of course you're right to pick that out. I mean, for various reasons, that's not unfraught, of course. One important reason in which it's not unfraught is that, as you could tell from the narration, quite a bit of the book, at least, except when it's in Vanessa's head or Helen's.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Head is from the, 80% of it is from Alan's perspective. So there is that slight awkwardness that I've certainly written about as a critic quite a bit, and sometimes I've prosecuted rather hard, which is, does someone like Alan, who's a educated person but not a literary person, does he sort of notice these things in the same way that I do? This used to occupy me more than it does now. When I wrote How Fiction Works, I was really concerned about it. Too concerned, I think. And actually, there was an LRB contributor, Thomas Jones, reviewed it in the Telegraph, I think, How Fiction Works, and said, I don't know why he's always banging on about this tension in fiction between, what the author sees and what the character sees. Why is it such a big deal? Of course the character sees more than the actual person in the street would really see. That's the contract. And I remember reading that and thinking, sort of feeling a relief in a way. So maybe I'm just thoroughly self-serving. To go back to the earlier question, there's a part of me that I probably will never be able to switch off, which is assessing some of the details you mentioned in the way that I would as a critic. Okay, is that good? Does that work? Is that the right thing? But of course, writers are doing this. I mean, non-critical-minded writers are doing this the whole time too, or they wouldn't be thinking properly about their work. So I feel it to be the part of the basic difficulty, and I specifically didn't want I wanted to write as I would write, but I didn't want the out that you get with certain stylists, with sort of Bello making his professors, brilliant notices so that they can notice up to the level of Bello, or Nabokov making his murderers, giving his murderers fancy prose styles and so on. That's always seemed, I didn't want to do that. But I guess neither did I want to entirely forego that noticing eye.
What I want to ask is, as a critic, of which I've read almost everything you've written, so prepare to be flattered for a second. It seems to me that sentence by sentence, as a sentence maker, you are one of the best writers of critical prose, perhaps ever. Let's set aside Samuel Johnson. I'm wondering, are you going one-on-one with the writers? Are you setting a bar? Because you must be conscious of your sentence making as a critic. Mm. And some of the writers that you're reviewing perhaps aren't as gifted a sentence maker as yourself. Uh-huh. And I do. There may not be a question mark at the end of this statement, but I'm struggling to get there. But it seems to me that there is something about how you've chosen to write your criticism, which is about sentence making.
Yeah.
And I think implicit when I read your criticism, I'm thinking if you don't mention the other person's sentence writing, you're sort of saying it's not up. It doesn't reach my bar.
Yeah.
Of course, you're a very generous critic as well, but there is a toughness about what you think or what you regard as the right level of sentence making that a writer must hit.
Yeah. Well, I'll take the flattery. Thank you for that. But I'll take the flattery partly because I don't rest easily. In other words, you're absolutely right to, interestingly, this goes back to the early question. You're absolutely right to put your finger on this sentence making thing. But that is an aspect of my writing that I increasingly dislike and would like to escape from. So,
can I just say that when yeah. you read, you're actually, I felt actually the sense of making it was a little, a
yes.
little softer,
yes.
a little less conscious
yeah.
than I'd expected, and from the Book Against God.
Right, definitely. Book Against God was overwritten. And it's not, so this does go back to, in a way to the How Fiction Works thing. And it's clear to me now that in that book, I was trying to work out something that is my inheritance. Put talent aside, you know, we all have varying degrees of it, right? But I think now that I'm old enough to look back properly, I can see that my particular inheritance has to do with having a very musical background and having music before literature. So it was thoroughly put God away. I mean, God, there was too much God, but there was never too much music. So there was lots of music, and that was really what my existence was from the age of sort of 8 to 13. It was that particular indentured servitude of the cathedral chorister. It's essentially like being in a music conservatory, and I was also doing two musical instruments in addition to the singing. So really, my life was music. Then literature came along, as it probably was always going to come along. And music was not an option anyway for professionally. I just wasn't good enough at those things. But now I could see that really all along, I've been worrying away at this question of how musical a novel should be, how musical should fiction be, which, if you put it in another way, is how formalist should the novelist be, right? That old sort of Iris Murdoch thing of the crystalline versus the journalistic, right? I don't like the journalistic much, and I tend to fault that for not enough sentence making. But the crystalline is not journalistic enough, and we all feel that too. We know when we're experiencing fiction, maybe my first novel being an example, that's somehow overwritten. It would be intolerable. I mean, I'm glad you heard voice in a way picking up and taking up the you know, occupying some of the slack. I increasingly go back to this thing, this very wise thing that Virginia Woolf said. I know I've quoted it about four times, but you know, it makes it easy when I write it in the New Yorker, because the fact checkers don't have to go outside the magazine to find the facts. They just go to my last piece and say, "Oh, well, he's using that one again." But this Virginia Woolf quote about that she said in a review. I mean, of all people, she said it. She said, "But the novelist doesn't write in sentences. The novelist writes in chapters and." Paragraphs and chapters. And what she was clearly saying there, although she didn't expand on it, is there's a thing called novelistic form, which is the rhythm of a whole inquiry. And that takes up a whole book. And my quarrel, I'm sure it's shared by plenty of people in this audience, with certain kinds of Flaubertian formalism, most obviously occupied currently by someone like Martin Amis, is this absurd idea that, you know, an entire 12-volume sequence is somehow pulled apart because there was one duff sentence in volume 6. That's not what it's about. If a real novelistic inquiry which was done in paragraphs and chapters was proceeding, it couldn't be unraveled by the fact that someone says, you know, that the writer at one point said he put down his glass and sneezed. You know, it's like, so what? That seems and that's the only way I can. It's a real division, and it might be a division in you, interestingly, to pick up from the certain emphasis in your question. But I find it a real division. Like, I mean, I'll read a book where I'm very excited by every, as it were, every sentence or every other sentence. And then I'll read, and it's not just because it's in translation. I'm reading this Norwegian writer, Dag Solstad, at the moment, who I love, but if you were going through it sentence by sentence, it's absolutely atrocious. I mean, I wish I had the book here with me, actually, if I'd read it out to you. It's like, he uses the verb pop up four times in the first two pages, you know. T. Singer would stop every so often in the middle of the road when this traumatic thought popped up in his consciousness, and then three lines later, whenever this thought popped up in his consciousness, you think, what is going on? This is sort of, you know, Martin Amis with a pen, was not quite at that level, I don't think. But, you know, you can see how this is the old thing of aesthetics versus ethics, right? It can't just be down to, it's why Jonathan Franzen was completely wrong in that Harper's essay to say, you know, blah, 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 but the sentence will save us. The sentence won't save us. It's got to be something beyond the sentence. It's that lovely thing in To the Lighthouse. You know, Lily Briscoe is trying to get hold of the thing itself before it has been made anything. That's the real, I would say, metaphysical quest of art. And that somehow goes beyond and before the sentence. Which? To the Lighthouse. So my favorite of his books, he only has four or five in English, is called Shyness and Dignity. I truly recommend that book, Shyness and Dignity. Fabulous. It's about a school teacher who's taught the same Ibsen text. I mean, he's got a good sense of humor. He's taught the same Ibsen play for the last 25 years, and he comes into school one day in Oslo, and he's, you know, miserable, and the kids aren't responding. And he suddenly realizes there's a parenthesis, a stage direction, which is something, it's attached to something a woman says about a lover. And the parenthesis is something like voice breaking, trembling, something like that. He realizes he'd never noticed it properly or attended to it until this moment. And he starts talking wildly about it. And the kids are absolutely, they respond as if nothing's changed, right? But for him, everything's changed. And he gets so enraged with them that he walks out of the classroom, makes a fool of himself in the school yard, and realizes he's said farewell to his job, quits the school, and basically the rest of the novel is him walking back home and thinking over the ramifications of what he's done and some of the history that had got him to this point. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and it probably doesn't have, in that formalist sense, it probably doesn't have more than, you know, five decent sentences in it. I mean, like dual sentences. No.
Considering your reputation and the fact that you wrote a book called How Fiction Works, you're, you know, no doubt aware that many critics, especially, would read you with, you know, an eyebrow raised, in the sense that you're a critic
who's writing about novels.
So, in that context, can you speak to risk taking and the what I imagine was that maybe inclination to just do it right and just get away with it in a way, make the sentences good, do it all properly without taking huge risks that would, you know, elevate, you know, a novel, because the best novels, of course, take huge risks. So was there an inclination to just do it and just publish it and hope that there wasn't anything terrible?
Yeah, thank you. That's right. That's exactly right. Well, here's the thing. I think there probably was that inclination on my part, but it didn't do any good anyway, because they all shat on it, so it doesn't matter. In other words, yes, I could have done a sort of 600 page thing where I was really, where I guess in some ways I was risking more, although I'll come back to that in a minute. And in many ways, this is a fairly quiet and reasonably, apart from the amount of interiority, a reasonably conventionally written, conventionally sort of plotted book that takes place over 6 days. But I suppose I took the risk of pleasing myself. That's to say, I followed particular interests and a particular way of writing. And it would seem, at least from a number of the reviews, I'm thinking of one in the Observer, where the critic said, probably not wrongly actually, that the characters didn't really seem to do anything and they were just spent their time thinking, and that the thoughts were, I think the phrase was, laughably well organized. Fine, but it could be, speaking very selfishly or somewhat narcissistically, it could be from just talking about me, from my point of view, that whatever I do, whether it's wildly ambitious or fairly quiet, there's going to be a problem, just that it's a critic, right? I think it was something like the Evening Standard had something like well-known critic takes a turn as an author, as if somehow the last 20 years had nothing to do with writing. It's like, you know, ballet dancer takes a turn at being an author, rock musician takes it, rather odd. But anyway, that notion of sort of that the critic is taking a turn as an author is, I think, going to be the main problem, irrespective of what I do. But I was going to say a little earlier, just that I hate you using this phrase, as I've got older, but I like the idea of something that isn't, that's somewhat more quietly ambitious. I'm drawn to fiction that has a certain tact and that lets the reader slowly catch up, as opposed to a certain kind of fiction, we know what that is, that announces itself very stridently from the beginning as a major and ambitious piece of work. Say like Richard Powers, right? Right? There's no way, no one's going to say about a 600-page book, I'm talking about his latest, that's about trees and three generations, blah, 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 immigration to America, that it's not ambitious. So you could say from his point of view, he hasn't taken any risks. A risk for Richard Powers would be to write a book like that. And so I hereby challenge you, Richard Powers, to write Upstate, not your latest 600-pager about trees.
Recently, I asked quite a few people I know if they had a favorite review, not a review of their favorite book, but if the reviews that had changed the way they saw books or a particular book, and a lot of them said you, so more praise. Huh. And I wondered if you had ever thought about, and if you've done this already, I'm sorry, thought of doing like a how reviews work, or how, because I think that's writing too, and that's a craft, and you're free.
Yeah, that's a nice idea. And thank you for saying that. Of course, I do spend a bit of time thinking about how reviews work, although mainly I just spend time, you know, working at reviews, which is doubtless less fun. It is, of course, and that's how most of us are going to read criticism, if anyone reads criticism anymore, which I doubt. But I mean, that's where it is. And I suppose in that regard, even though, you know, How Fiction Worked was a book, written as a book, it, I suppose, came from the same space. That's to say, or it's talking to the same readership, which is the sort of readership who would read review, who read reviews, and isn't an academic readership. And I suppose I've always thought of criticism as, I mean, the criticism I love and the criticism that I started reading before I went to university and read while I was at university, in addition to the academic stuff, was always this, was essentially reviews, right? You know, if you look at, well, you know, I think that you mentioned Samuel Johnson, but, you know, all that great stuff, sort of Hazlitt and Virginia Woolf's essays for sure. You know, remember, 10 years, I think, before Woolf writes, puts a pen to paper fictionally, she's been working as a jobbing reviewer anonymously for the TLS. That's where she began. That's how she began. So yes, it's a way of being that I take very seriously. Whether there's much to be said about how it works, I don't know, because how it works, of course, is changing so massively. I mean, just at the sort of institutional level, that increasingly people just reading it online and then probably skimming it in ways that maybe they didn't a few years. I don't know. But anyway, thank you for the question.
So to follow up from the earlier distinction you drew between sentence making and novelistic inquiry, this isn't just a novel about a philosopher, it's also an intensely philosophical novel itself.
And yes.
So at least three things that I picked up in my reading, three concerns. One was the nature of parenthood or fatherhood, as something that goes on throughout life, and it doesn't just end when your children leave the home. But also the fact that Alan, as with the novel opens with this, is a son as well as a father, and I saw a potential link there to essays you'd written about being a son and being a son-in-law as well. The second would be the nature of happiness, why some people are happy, why they aren't, this provocative idea that we have a sort of fixed supply of happiness, that different people have a different supply. And then thirdly, you mentioned the criticism that not much happens in the book.
Yeah.
I think there's a real sense of impermanence. Alan Quarry thinks at the start of the book that the House of Quarry is built on sand, if I recall correctly. Whether it's Helen's career in music, Vanessa and Josh's relationship, all the sort of narrative tension comes from the sense that things aren't as stable as they might look. And then there's a profound feeling of impermanence. And I think there's been a sort of misapprehension about your criticism over the years, that you're more concerned with brilliant details or serious noticing than with the novelist argument, or was actually, I think a lot of your criticism does deal with those things. And Jenny Oppenbeck, for example, is quietly ambitious, but also novelistic inquiry that you've championed.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could speak a bit more to how you saw these philosophical arguments in this novel and to this novel as a novel of inquiry.
Yeah, well, thank you. I certainly do like both the, I don't want to keep everyone, but so it's almost time to go, but I certainly do like both the comic and I suppose the tragicomic premise that someone who's employed to teach philosophy doesn't really know how to live. Shouldn't be a surprise, should it? I mean, we can't think ourselves into or read ourselves into happiness. And if an unhappy person came to you, your first response wouldn't be, well, just go away and read some Aristotle or bone up on Heidegger, you know? But clearly that's a nice thing that I wanted there in the book. And you're absolutely right that I'm very much pursuing in the book something that I think occupies us all and occupies any parent, particularly as you see your children. As you see your children getting older, what you see, of course, is what you can't control and what you could never control. I mean, you actually thought you could, but that was an illusion. And you, of course, also see what is inherited, right? And it could be, sometimes it's a wonderful surprise, like, oh, this kid isn't anything like me. That's kind of terrific. Then it can be less happy, should we say. And I started thinking about, I've thought about this for a long time, because I sort of grew up in a family with certain amount of happiness and a certain amount of very entrenched unhappiness that had been inherited. And that gets you thinking as a kid, you know, why is one parent happy and the other parent unhappy? Or why is it so difficult for my younger sibling and maybe for my older sibling, but not for me in the middle? Is that some accident of birth order? Could it be that it was something that just you were born with, right? Could you actually think, are you born with happiness and unhappiness? I don't know. You're born with certain talents and aptitudes. This is for sure. You're born with certain intelligence that no amount of expansion will particularly improve. Maybe happiness is like that. If that's the case, then that's very grim indeed. And then, of course, for the parent, the difficulty is that terrible anxiety about seeing that there's very little you could do about anything. This extraordinary line from Norman Rush's novel Mortals is one that I come back to a lot. I just think about it a lot. I wish I'd written it. It's a line where he says, having children, he talks about hell mouth, birth, the mouth of hell sort of bursting through the life you put over it. And he says, having children creates more thin spaces in the world for hell mouth to break through. And I think that apprehension of the of thin space, that of terror really, is along with all the joy, is very much part of the thing of being a parent. And I thought that would be worth writing about. I'm glad also you noticed that yes, the novel begins with Alan going to his mother and ends with Alan deciding to stick around in America with his daughter. So there's a formal circle there, I hope. I think we should wrap it up. One more. Yeah.
So James, you were talking just before about critics criticizing you as a novelist and you being a critic.
Yeah.
Do you think that any critics of your latest work have held you to standards or pronouncements that you made years ago? And what do you think about
that? I love these leading questions. You just fall into them. I fall into your lap. And I say, thank you for feeding me that nice one. I'll talk to you afterwards and there will be money will change hands. Yes, I mean, clearly that goes on a little bit. I knew what the template would be because the template was set up in 2003 when my first novel came out. And the template is, Wood has incredibly high standards, always calls for masterpieces, though that's actually less and less true as I get older and wiser. Calls for masterpieces, is his contribution a masterpiece? No, it is not. And then the review can proceed, once that little machine has been set up, can proceed to go forward. Yeah, it's interesting. A couple of cases, it wasn't just that there was that template. It was striking to see things that I had written when I was about 30, which is now 22 years ago, about, you know, what do you say when you're 30 or 28 or 27? You say stuff like, there hasn't been any decent fiction in Britain since 1945. Of course you do, you're young, right? And then when you're 52, you think with shame and embarrassment that you said such things. Although maybe it's a little bit true. But you know, basically more shame than justice in the remark. And then suddenly someone's saying, why shouldn't she? Well, Wood, in 1998, he did say, or 1992, whatever it is, he did say, you know, there have only been two decent writers, you know, V.S. Naipaul and Muriel Spark since 1945. Though actually, as it turns out, not bad, right? Muriel Spark, V.S. Naipaul, Pinter, that's two or three others, and that's it. But then you think, first of all, God, did I say that? And then you think to yourself, but I don't agree with that anymore. And then, of course, the corollary is, how could the review possibly go well for me after this, right? It's like, it couldn't go well for me. It's like, I think it's, you know, there's something very, it's wrong to use the word shrewd because it suggests a sort of deliberation where I think actually it's more like purity, but there is something in a way very shrewd about someone like Ishiguro who has given no hostages to fortune like that. And also it means you can go to the fiction, right? It's tedious to go to Martin Amis's fiction and always know what he thinks about X, Y, and Z. That came in, you see, X, Y, and Z. But you go to Ishiguro and there's no paper trail. There's no sort of, you said this then and you gave this interview and said this. It's just what it is. And that seems quite appealing to me. But hopeless, I mean, you know.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you for your questions and contributions. Most of all, James Wood, thank you so much for reading and talking. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.